WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen in for Terry Gross. That's the sound of a collision of football players as captured by NFL Films. They were the first to mic players and coaches and have changed the way that sports fans have viewed and enjoyed football. The look and feel of an NFL film is unmistakable, reverential, and larger than life, and its mission is clear: to glorify the sport. In its 35-year history, NFL Films has filmed thousands of football games, boasts a sports library of more than 20 million feet of film, produced more than 3,000 TV shows and specials, and won 69 Emmys. On August 17th, the National Geographic Explorer will air their documentary on NFL Films called The Idolmakers on TBS. I spoke with the president of NFL Films, Steve Sable, son of the founder. He played football through high school and college before being hired by his father to work at the company. I asked him when filming a game today, how big a crew he sends on the field.
The best way to explain that would be that live television usually uses between 12 and 15 cameras at a game. We use three. And everybody's, oh, see, now even you're surprised,
your
eyebrows, yeah, that's right. We have three cameramen, a top man who's called a tree. He's rooted in the position, and he gives you your basic top coverage. Then we have a mole, and he's a handheld mobile cameraman that shoots a camera from the ground with a focal length lens of 12 to 240, which is a fairly dramatic zoom. And once in a while, he's connected to a sound man. Then we have a third cameraman who's called a weasel, and it's his job to shoot everything but the action. Now, when I was a cameraman, I was a weasel, and I shot the first 15 Super Bowls, and I never saw a play, but because I was always shooting the coaches or the fans or some of the little details. So those are really the three elements, the three types of cinematographers that we have at every game.
And is that the hierarchy with the weasel at the bottom?
Well, I think that when people think of NFL films, they think of the action shots. But being a former weasel myself, I think that that actually the weasels are part of the storytellers. I was an art major in college, and I remember studying Paul Cézanne, who once said that all art is selected detail. And when we started NFL Films, I always felt there should be a cameraman that just has an eye for the details, the cleat marks in the mud, the way the sun comes through the portals of a stadium, the silhouette of a coach walking against the sunlit stands. And that was an element that I, when I started to shoot, that I focused on. So I think a weasel really is important, although certainly not as important as the guys that shoot the action.
Are there certain cameramen you think that specialize in a certain kind of shot? Is there a guy that kind of has a weasel personality that you know is just going to get those details and some of that background stuff?
Well, when you think of NFL films, you think, well, we're specialized in football. But within that specialization, there are specialists. There are cameramen that specialize just in shooting a telephoto lens, just shooting the trademark, our ball spiraling slowly through the air. A weasel is strictly an eye. A weasel doesn't have to know anything about football.
Really?
But nothing. I mean, at Super Bowls, we usually have guest weasels. A couple years ago, we had Haskell Wexler, the Academy Award-winning director and DP for Medium Cool, and he weaseled for us.
What did he get for you?
He got a couple. It was a lot out of focus, believe it or not. But but he did, as you know, as you'd expect, a cameraman of his talent. He came up with a few shots and angles that none of us who were so immersed in the game would have ever thought of.
You say that your mission is to act as storytellers, to tell the story of football or the story of a particular kind of a game. I think the language of football often is about doing battle. Is that what you think the story of football is? About
warfare?
Well,
I think it's a very militaristic sport, and I think that's part of the popularity. I think it's, you know, they always say that cultures can be defined by their games. When you look at the Greeks, they had the Olympics. The Romans had the Colosseum. And I think in a certain way now that you can look at our society and compare it maybe to the Middle Ages when the whole towns were built around cathedrals and churches. And now when you look at towns, are these in giant stadiums that in many ways, maybe a little bit of a stretch, that you could say that this is sort of a religion now with these giant stadiums, and the congregation gathers every Sunday to worship at the or certainly to be entertained or to draw some sort of emotional sustenance from the sport.
Well, why do you think then that football has really then supplanted baseball as the nation's pastime?
Well, I think football is I wouldn't say that, Marty, it's our pastime. Football is our national passion. And I think that in many ways it mirrors our culture. George Will had an interesting description of football. We were interviewing him for a show, and he said that football is popular because it's just like our society. It's a series of committee meetings punctuated by moments of violence. but I think they're thing that the first of all, that you look at television and how that has shaped our culture. And if football hadn't been invented or hadn't evolved out of rugby 100 years ago, sometime in the 1950s, a group of television executives, after a 6-martini lunch, would have gotten together and said, what thing can we create that's going to draw viewers and that's going to be perfect to televise for the game of television? And when you look at football, the field is shaped like a television screen, and you compare it to baseball. Baseball's all geometry. It's very hard to cover baseball on television. But football has a sense of ebb and flow. It's like a good conversation. There's a play, and then they regroup for the huddle, and you have a chance to reflect on what you've seen. Opposed to basketball or soccer, which is like one continuous monologue. You know, there's no chance to sit and reflect and talk about what happened, and also to talk about what's going to happen next. So football has this sort of conversational feel to it that's perfect for television.
And time out to run down for that second beer.
Right, or commercials, too. Okay.
But do you think that you have, and the folks at NFL Films, have really then contributed to the development of the passion for this game?
I think we have, but in sort of a naive and innocent way. I think when we started, it was four or five of us, and it was just at the time a bunch of young guys who loved to make movies and who loved pro football and wanted to convey that love of the game to our audience. Now people look back at what we did and say, boy, you guys were great marketers, you were great packagers, you were great promoters, what a great advertising arm. But we never thought that way. And I still never think of NFL Films as promoting or advertising or marketing. We're just passionate observers of a sport that we all love. And in the beginning, we were allowed to do that. I mean, Pete Rozelle, who was a commissioner, never told me or my father, I want you to do this, I want you to do that. In fact, and this shows you how prescient he was as a commissioner, he kept us separate from New York. He kept us, we were from Philadelphia, and he let the company grow and evolve in Philadelphia. And he always told me and my father that it was good that way because we would be able to take risks, that we would be separated from the corporate culture and the league, and that we could develop as filmmakers. Because I always felt that it was important to be able to take the risk, to try new things. And if you have to go through a series of committees, that never happens.
And yet I know you're aware of some of the criticism that NFL Films provides a kind of propaganda for the game, because it does glorify the game.
Sure,
there's
does.
No question about
but,
it.
But in that respect, I go back to my background as an art major, that there were certain artists that depicted things in a certain way. And if you wanted to show the horrors of war, Goya would be a good person to paint. If you wanted the glory of war, it could be Jericho or Delacroix that would paint those paintings. So we're sort of artists, but this is just our way of interpreting the way we feel about the sport. Now, if someone says, well, that's you're glorifying it, well, I love the game, and that's the way I feel about it.
But we're not going to hear about drug scandals and other scandals when we watch
from
NFL Films.
Because you'll see that and you'll hear that on the networks, on the hard news. And we've never said that we are journalists. We are not journalists. We're storytellers. We're romanticists. That's what we've looked on ourselves. But we've never tried to convince anybody that we're journalists, that this is investigative reporting. It isn't. I mean, we still shoot film, which is a good reason. I mean, right there separates us from the electronic news media.
Let's talk a little bit about your father, who founded NFL Films. And my understanding is that he was the home photographer.
Oh, yeah.
That you were doing something, your dad was taking a picture of it.
Well, my dad, first of all, to me, I don't know how many sons can look at their father and say that they were their hero, their father, the funniest person they ever met, the best man at my wedding, my boss. All of those things pertain to my father. And NFL Films really began with a wedding present. My dad was an overcoat salesman in the 1950s, and when he was married, as a wedding present, my grandmother gave him a little wind-up Bell & Howell movie camera. And everything that I did as his first and only son, there was my dad filming. My first haircut, my first pony ride, my first birthday, my first football game. And every football game that I played in from the time I was in fourth grade to the time I graduated Haverford School in 1960, there was my dad on top of the chemistry building at Haverford School in Lancaster Avenue filming me playing football. So by the time I'd been accepted at Colorado College, he'd gotten good enough at filming football that he felt that he was going to make this his profession. He dropped out of the overcoat business and took the money that he'd saved up and started a film company. And the first film that he did was called To Catch a Whale. And they went out off Rhode Island, and not only did they not catch a whale, but my dad got really seasick, and the salt water destroyed two of the cameras, so he figured that he was not going to go in the rain. You know, he's not going to become a National Geographic. He said he'd go back to doing football. And in 1961, the film rights for the NFL championship game had sold to an independent film producer for $1,500. And my dad decided that he would, next year, he was going to get the rights no matter what. So he figured he would double the bid. He went to New York when they had the auction for the film rights. This is for the championship game. He doubled the bid, $3,000, won the bid. And Pete Rozelle opening up my dad's bid, usually in the past, they'd make that, you know, they'd say, well, this bid has been won by Ed Sable, and he's going to be doing the championship game. But Pete Rozelle opened it up, saw the amount of money, and then quickly read over my dad's resume. And became a little concerned when he saw that his only experience filming football was filming his 14-year-old son. So he just said, Ed, I'd like to talk to you for a second. And then they went out to lunch. And after several drinks at 21, my dad and Pete came to an agreement that Pete would let my dad film the 62 championship game. And that's when I got the phone call, and that's when Dad hired Bob Ryan and Art Spieler and Walter Dumbrow, the three people in the company, and that's how... Well, it was actually Blair Motion Pictures then. It was named after my sister. We didn't become NFL Films until 3 years later.
So your dad was a good salesman.
He had a tremendous entrepreneurial vision, and he kept NFL Films alive for the first 4 or 5 years. A lot of people think that our style came out of our first film. It didn't. It wasn't until 1966 when we did a film called They Call It Pro Football, and we used a narrator by the name of John Facenda. That was the Citizen Kane of sports movies there. That's when we made the break from what had been done in the past to what I think has influenced all sports movie making today.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. And our guest today is Steve Sable, and he's president of NFL Films. And a National Geographic Explorer has done a documentary of NFL Films. It's called Inside NFL Films, and it will air on August 17th. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is Steve Sable today, and he's president of NFL Films. Let's talk a little bit about the music, because certainly that's a very important ingredient in the making of and certainly the viewing of NFL Films, again, to kind of heighten the drama and the experience. What is it about that song, What Do We Do With a Drunken Sailor?
I mean,
hasn't that appeared several times in an NFL film?
That's almost our theme song. And when we started in the 60s, I felt it would be very important to develop a musical style that would be unique to football. And it wasn't the John Philip Sousa Oompa Oompa music, but something that was movie music that told a story. And as a kid going to Blue Mountain Camp in the Poconos, every Friday night we'd have these campfires and we'd sing these songs. And one of the songs, you know, What Do You Do With a Drunken Sailor? But it was one of those hummable things that you'd hum next day when you were playing softball or you're out canoeing. You'd be going, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So when we started NFL Films, that's the kind of music I wanted, but not done with just a single instrument, but with a 50 or 60 piece orchestra. So we found this composer by the name of Sam Spence, and he was working in California at the time, and we hit it off great. And I would hum some of these melodies to him, sometimes over the phone,
melodies.
Camp songs. And he would, they would come back with 50 strings and flugelhorns and French horns and these incredible arrangements. And it also, like John Facenda, helped create a unique style or became a signature of our movies.
So it's possible then to watch some NFL films and hunt for some camp songs that might be embedded in the soundtrack there.
Oh, sure. There are a lot of the...
kind of like Where's Waldo version of that.
But, you know, when you think of how important music is in our lives, you get married to music, you get buried to music, you go to war to music, people make love to music. So, and I remember watching Gone with the Wind that was 222 minutes long, and there's like only 19 or 20 minutes in that whole movie that doesn't have music. And football is a sport that people associate with music, and it's so important to help build the drama and tell the story.
So is that how you work with a composer, which is literally humming in some songs over a telephone
well,
and then they go from there?
That's how we did it for the first 15 years. Now we have two composers, full-time composers, Tom Hedden and Dave Robideau, who work in our NFL films and do all the composing right there on a synthesizer. And then we take their outlines on a synthesizer, and then it goes over to the London Symphonic Orchestra, and we do it over there.
I wonder whether, when you look at NFL films and you've never seen a football game, whether your expectations then are greater than what the game actually delivers. I was reading about a story, I think it took place in Japan, where Japanese people had seen NFL films before they actually saw a real live football game. They were terribly disappointed and apparently booed and hissed through all the game, looking for something that looked like NFL films.
Well, they thought that there would be the music.
Right.
They thought that they would hear the sound of the coaches. Mm-hmm. They thought that they didn't understand what these huddles were. They didn't see that in our film. So they started to hiss, and nobody could understand. This was in 1974 when the first NFL game was played over in Tokyo. It was the Cardinals and the Chargers. And Dan Dierdorf, who does the Monday night broadcast, was at the game, and he was the one that told the story to me. He says they were hissing, and we didn't understand what it was until later an interpreter explained that they had seen these films, and they wanted to know where the music was and why did it take so long and why they couldn't hear the sound, and it wasn't at all what they expected.
So they rather get the film version of football than the real thing. Well, if you have all these archives, all these movies in your archives, how would you say football has changed? How
well,
is it different
today? Well,
I think
the stadiums have changed the game, especially the domes. They've sterilized the game. You look at a game in the Kingdom or in the Astrodome, which fortunately is not going to be used anymore, and it looks like an inside of an aquarium. The players look like little freeze-dried peas. It doesn't have the sense of grandeur and the mythic quality of the passing of the seasons that you see in the open-air stadiums. I think that's changed. I think the players have changed in a way in that there's a sense of entitlement now among the players that all this they're entitled to. Where players in the 50s and 60s, there was a sense of gratitude that they were privileged to be part of this, to be part of the league, to play a game like football. Now there's more of a sense of, like I said, well, they're owed this. There's this entitlement. So there is a difference, a little different, I think, feeling. And that goes back to colleges, too, because the athletes today in colleges are incredibly pampered. And mm-hmm. And that's one thing that people don't realize when you go to you see how a football team operates. I mean, these players are, every hour of the day is regimented. You eat breakfast. This is when you get dressed. Now you get in your car, you go to the bus, you go to the stadium. You're back from the stadium. We have a meeting. I mean, it's almost very similar to still being in school. So there's a certain immaturity there. And a lot of the players, once they get out of the game, are suddenly they have this incredible free, undisciplined time, and it's hard to make that adjustment.
What do you make of the diehard football fans? I had a chance to go to a Eagles game a couple of years ago and was up way up in the nosebleed section where mm-hmm. the hardcore fans are, most of them extremely drunk. Mm-hmm. It was an extraordinary show, I will say. Lots of war paint, lots of hoopla, you know, lots of carrying
well,
on there.
Really
What's that
changed?
About,
I
you
don't
think?
Know. You know, that's an interesting thing, and we've done some pieces on that, and you could see how the fans have changed. When we started in the 60s, first of all, there was no NFL properties. So you didn't have all the team identification that you have now. And people were really into the game. But as television came along, the fan became part of the spectacle himself. And that's when you started with a high mom and the fan shot. So then the fan came to the game, not only to watch the game, but the fan felt that now he is part of this. He is part of the spectacle himself. So that's where you end up with these outrageous outfits and this whole thing where the fan now becomes part of the spectacle himself, which was different in the beginning when the fan was just a spectator.
In this documentary about NFL films, I think one of the cameramen says that as soon as you put a camera on a fan, their IQ drops about 20 points.
Yeah, it's true. And it's that was a problem that began, I think, and I'd blame Monday Night Football for that, because I remember being a weasel as a cameraman. You could go up and you could shoot a player or a fan, and they would never look at the camera. They'd be involved in the game. Then, I believe it was in 1972, it was a Jets game, that one of the Jets, I believe it was Don Maynard, scored a touchdown and came to the sidelines. And the Monday night cameraman came over to him and couldn't get a face shot of him. So the director, Chet Forty, said, tap him on his shoulder and tell him he's on camera. So the cameraman did that. Don Maynard turned around, looked at the camera, and I guess didn't know what to do. And he said, hi, mom. And that was the beginning of the high mom syndrome, which fans saw, players saw. And from then on, it was terrible for us because we couldn't get a good documentary shot because fans thought we were they couldn't tell the difference between two cameras.
Right.
They'd see us, and instead of cheering or a player talking about the game, they'd look at us and say, hi, mom, or, you know, what they do now. And those shots are worthless to us. We can't use them. So that was one of the bigger problems we had during the 70s and the 80s. Now, like I said, fans are part of the spectacle themselves.
Steve Sabol is president of NFL Films. On August 17th, the National Geographic Explorer airs their documentary on NFL Films called The Idol Makers on TBS. I'm Marty Moscowen, and this is Fresh Air.